from doing so. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the EU, led by the U.S., is willing to sacrifice its economy and its people in order to sanction Russia with no real substitute strategy in place. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Harley Schlanger, spokesman for La Ruche organization, joins us from Potsdam, Germany. Also joining us, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General at SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Harley Schlanger, let me first start with you. Let's first look at the Russian demand for rubles. It's going great, according to what we're seeing. Russia's ruble, the currency, is the most profitable currency, as it's been reported, for the month of March. And, of course, this comes after the U.S. said that it's just going to tank, and people said the ruble is going to turn into rubble. What do you attribute that to?
Well, there are two basic points. The first is that the Russian ruble is backed by something real, unlike the dollar, the pound, the euro, which are backed by printing presses. The ruble is backed by the physical economy of Russia. For one, Russia has a lot of gold, but they also produce wheat. They produce strategic metals. They produce timber. And so when countries trade in rubles, they are getting something that has some intrinsic value beyond just the paper money. At this point, the dollar, the only value of the dollar is the insistence of the U.S. that it's backing up the dollar by the United States economy, which is actually the economy that's tanking. So on the one hand, the Russian ruble is relatively stable. As you pointed out, it's back at its pre-war level after it had really gone down for a while. And it was a very clever move by President Putin to protect the Russian economy, to demand that the gas payments and oil payments be made in rubles.
Okay, let's take a look at the stance of the EU, the European Commission. Paolo Raffone has made a statement saying that it has no information that any European company has paid in rubles for Russian gas. Do you find that a bit odd that they would have no information when there are at least 10 European countries who have continued their purchases?
Well, officially, no country has acknowledged that they paid in ruble. Probably it is happening, but behind the curtains. And this is because of the enormous pressure that the United States has put on the European authorities that did not authorize any of the member states to do so. So what will happen, I cannot predict, but I may say that there is a certain difficulty among the member states because of the impact that sanctions are having on the already weakened economic perspective. So if we go on like this by the summer, it would be really economically catastrophic. And the winter to come will be socially unmanageable. So that's why probably behind closed doors and behind the curtains, something is happening that can be acknowledged.
So behind closed doors, our guest there, Harley Schlanger, says that the purchases are being made. And from what I understood from Paolo Raffone, it is the U.S. that's pressuring the EU countries. What is it that the U.S. is doing to pressure these countries that they have to come out I'm not going to use the word lie, but they have to come out and paraphrase maybe, or say an alternate explanation. What type of pressure is the U.S. exerting on them, if you agree with our guests there from Brussels?
Well, first of all, one thing that I can confirm is that there are 10 European companies which are in the gas, oil and gas business, which have opened accounts at the Gazprom Bank. Now, this is the demand that the Russians made. The way that you can do the trading is that you deposit dollars or euros or pounds in an account in the Gazprom Bank, and then they'll put rubles in an account that you also are holding there that can then be used to pay for oil and gas. So there are companies that have already done that, although haven't been named. Now, the pressure from the United States is enormous. And we saw that just last weekend with the meeting in Ramstein Air Base, where the German government, which up until April 22nd had insisted there would be no weapon shipments to Ukraine, suddenly reversed themselves. There's enormous pressure coming from the United States. On Germany, the Germans were told, if you don't go along with us, you'll be labeled an unreliable partner. And I think smaller countries are very much afraid that they'll be targeted for economic problems from the International Monetary Fund, from the banks. Many of these countries are facing payment crises coming up, and that's the leverage that the international banks out of London and Wall Street are holding over their heads.
So when you talk about that kind of pressure, are we talking about the fact that countries that may do business with Russia, even though they go the route of, for example, Gazprom Bank is where, I guess, the euros or dollars have to be deposited, turned into rubles, and then the purchase is made, that if they do that, that they're going to get pressured and maybe sanctioned because they're trying to make sure that their economy is going well, that it's sustainable, and that people are not starving or that they don't have to pay these enormous gas bills, that they're going to get penalized for that? This will be for Paolo Raffone.
Yeah, sure. Want to avoid that people take the streets, although already on the 1st of May we have seen a certain animosity in some of the streets across Europe. Things cannot go but worse if we do not stop this spiral of war in which Europe has nothing to do. Basically, we have been put into this war, which is technically taking place on European soil, but in fact is a war between the American perspective on the future of Europe and Eurasia and the Russian perspective on the same. So Europe is in between, and it has been summoned by the traditional ally, which is the United States, to follow suit in a war which is against Russia, which is practically a stupid move, because if something we should avoid is to have an enemy on our soil, which is Russia. So I see a very bleak future if we do not stop the war and we do not stop the sanctions, and we give a chance to peace, which means dialogue and find a solution, not arming people to defend themselves. This is not a way to calm the situation, and there will be no winner for a long time. So we risk to have a prolonged war, at different stages of warfare, but with no solution. And meanwhile, our economies will suffer, and people too.
When you take a look at the statements, Harley Schlanger, that's coming out from the EU, is something that I want to point out and then get your reaction on, which are the inconsistencies in what they are saying. And not just on one occasion, two occasion, or three occasions, on more than that. For example, right before this emergency meeting that the EU ministers had, you had two European Union diplomats who said the bloc is leaning toward a ban on imports of Russian oil by the end of the year. Then you have a statement coming from the EU commissioner that said, well, if you do go ahead in a warning to the countries that are going to go ahead with purchasing Russian gas through that dual system, as they called it, I believe, that they will be breaking the sanctions. What is the EU position here? I mean, are we to believe that the EU actually is forthright in wanting to stop their ultimate goal, stop purchasing Russian gas and oil? Or are they just saying that, as you said, to see if some time can go by, perhaps there'll be some kind of solution to the conflict.
Well, it's very difficult to see that the EU has an actual goal. The European Union, in my view, is very dysfunctional. The goal is the goal of the British and the Americans to weaken Russia, as Defense Secretary Austin said at the Rammstein meeting, as Biden said. Biden basically said the goal is regime change. So the bigger issue here is whatever happens in Europe on oil and gas is not the concern of the United States or the British. They don't care if the populations in Europe suffer from a shortage of electricity, which is going to happen. They don't care if their own people suffer because gas prices in the United States are rising through the roof. Their goal is to destroy Russia, and there's a reason for it. The Russian ruble policy is part of a bigger policy, which is the beginning of a shift away from the petrodollar system. And the February 4th agreements between Russia and China signaled a willingness of these two countries to stop the blackmail that comes from the International Monetary Fund and Wall Street and the City of London. And there's support for Russia and China from many of the formerly non-aligned nations, former colonial nations who know how bad the European colonizers are. And so the problem is the Europeans are sort of collateral damage, just as the Ukrainian people are. The Ukrainian people are being used as a battering ram against Russia.
Well, Paolo Raffone, but isn't the U.S. shooting itself in the foot when it comes to the dollar? I mean, one of the biggest mistakes, as was said by a Citi monetary financial advisor, he said that the day that the U.S. and its partners confiscated Russian currency and deposits overseas, that was the alarm bell that went off. For example, for China, that they have their money overseas and they have reserves also in dollars, that they're going to start dumping the dollar. And of course, you, as you're well aware, this is going to set off these dollars that are going to come back to the U.S. and then perhaps the U.S. is going to be headed into hyperinflation. So in that respect, more importantly, the dollar is being risked. Is the U.S. willing to take that risk, which it seems like it is?
Well, this is a common practice of the United States. I mean, this is not the first time that they've been seizing national assets, but until when they were doing it for small countries or islands or, you know, inoffensive groups of enemies, it was feasible. This time they've been touching one of the five members of the Security Council. By the way, is the second or the first nuclear power in the world. And this changes completely the effect of what they have done, because evidently this is a breach of the Washington Consensus, because Washington Consensus is grounded on the trust that you have in the rules that govern the world currency, which is the dollar. But if those rules are then breached, and you decide to take away the assets of another country just because you esteem that it is your enemy, well, then the role of the dollar is into question. And we already see some reactions in China. They would like to avoid a currency war to the dollar, because the dollar in itself technically is working well as a currency. The thing is that it is managed by a state that is evil.
If it's doing well, then why is it that Israel is getting rid of some of its dollars? That has come out and said last week it's a liability. Why is Saudi Arabia doing the same and both opting for the yuan?
Sure, they do that. Because if you had your huge assets deposited in dollars anywhere in the world, the United States government can come and take them from overnight because they decided you're an enemy country for whatever reason they have.
Right.
And
okay.
This is not something that is a rule. It's arbitrary.
Let's move through the EU countries. Number one powerhouse, economic powerhouse, Germany. Harley Schlanger, I said I'm going to talk about inconsistencies. And here is one that goes flat or right in the face of the EU, coming from the German, I believe, Minister of Economy, Vice Chancellor and Economy Minister Robert Habeck. Whether an overall oil embargo is about to happen, I don't know. I'm hearing different things, and I'm talking to my colleagues about different things. Other countries are not there yet, and I believe that should be respected. What do you think?
Well, first of all, Habeck is a completely immoral character. He's a leader of the Green Party. He's shutting down nuclear plants, he's shutting down coal plants, and he wants Germany to stop buying any oil and gas from Russia. And that's because of his green ideology. Now, German industry is saying that if Habeck's policy is carried out, then the German auto sector will collapse. There'll be 1.5 to 2 million jobs lost. The machine tool sector will collapse. This is one of the great strengths of Germany, the intersection between machine tools and new technologies. So what Habeck is doing is playing a very dangerous game. But I think, just to take one step back for a moment, the sanction policy, you mentioned before hypocrisy, the sanction policy itself is a hypocrisy. The idea that the West supposedly supports sovereignty and democracy, and yet if a country doesn't go along with it, they get crushed with sanctions under the so-called rules-based order. That's the hypocrisy there, and we see it in Germany in a big way. And there is a reaction developing in sections of the population, especially unionists, peace movement, the so-called left party, the Linke party, the so-called right party, the AfD. The real threat is that the Social Democrats, which used to be the peace party in Germany, has been completely submitted to the tyranny of the Greens and the Free Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we see the German situation heading toward over the cliff.
I'm not too sure where to start. I mean, I think it was actually Harley Schlanger in one previous program that you said that there are people in Germany that perhaps can't heat themselves because of the rise of energy costs. We have inflation that even the U.S. had a contraction that it reported negative 1.2% for its GDP contraction, which many are saying is going to perhaps lead to a recession. You have cooking oil that's being rationed in the U.K. The IMF has come out and issued a stern warning for the African continent that parts of it is going to probably have civil unrest because of lack of food. And I could keep going on and on. Of course, petrol and energy prices causing inflation in many countries. At what cost is this coming? I mean, is this a global conflict at this point, what we're looking at?
Yes, I would say that the conflict is occasionally taking place in Europe in a country called Ukraine, but in fact it's a global conflict. It is a conflict that has been boiling down for quite a while. I mean, it's not something that started in February 2022. This is something that roots back, I would say, to the 70s, and then with different moments it has popped out. But especially we can say that it has been very, very visible in 2001, 2008, and now in 2022. So it's all linked. And the fact is that the hegemony that has been imposed by the United States in this multilateral, what they call the multilateral governance of the world, but in fact it's unilateral masked by multilateral, this is no more sustainable. And they have to come to terms with themselves to accept that the world is larger, is much more complex than it was 50 years ago. And they have to open up in a sharing mood. But until when the United States doesn't make this process, we will face, all of us, a very, very worrying time with a lot of catastrophic consequences.
The rewards for Russia, Harley Schlanger, based on the report that has come out, is that it's going to have more income. It's going to rise sharply this year based on this report, $180 billion, despite the production cuts that have happened, and saying that one of the major attributes behind that is the rising oil prices, which will be 45% higher than last year. My question to you is, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a stop to the purchases made for Russian oil and gas. So isn't that a losing cause that the U.S. is leading and the EU supposedly is following, which it's really not, to say that they're going to try to suffocate Russia, at least in terms of its income?
Well, the whole thing is a losing cause. The problem that Europeans face is that the potential for trade with Russia is enormous, also with China. And they're cutting this off in order to support an intention of American and British bankers to sustain a collapsing financial system. And so the Europeans are essentially buying a sick horse here and trying to ride it. And it's not going to take them very far. You know, I think the deeper question here is that if you look at what Germany just did in terms of reversing its policy on arms shipments to Ukraine, it shows that Germany is still an occupied country for all intents and purposes. Its policies come from London and Wall Street. The foreign minister, Baerbock, basically is reading a script from Tony Blinken and from Liz Truss, the British foreign secretary. There's no independence in Europe. The Europeans are somewhat trapped in this fake illusion of a European Union, which is certainly what they might call a rules-based order, but rules that make no sense for the individual countries. And what I see is that the pressure on Russia is going to force more countries to pull back from trade with Europe. You see it already with countries like Nigeria, South Africa, Brazil, are talking with Russia and China. India is doing a special transaction system to have the ruble and the rupee transferable. The Chinese or the Saudis are accepting the yuan for payment in oil. So we're moving to a new financial system. I don't think the dollar system is dead yet because the dollar system still plays a role and the Chinese would not want to see it disappear. But they're not going to give up their sovereignty for the sake of being in the good graces with Washington and London.
Thank you for that, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at La Ruche Organization, Potsdam, Germany. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation from Brussels. Thank you. Well, with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakli, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وهو الذي خلق من الماء بشرا فجعله نسبا وصهرا وكان ربك قديرا.
And it is he who has created from semen a human being and made him a relative by lineage and marriage. And ever is your Lord competent concerning creation.
Dear listeners, we were discussing the 54th verse of Surah Al-Furqan. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا فَجَعَلَهُ نَسَبًا وَصِحْرًا وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا. And he it is who has created man from water. Then he made him related in blood and in wedlock, and your Lord is ever powerful. As you may remember, the previous verses were also discussing the Almighty Allah's blessings and the different forms of His mercies, the showers of mercies on the servants, and the benefits of the rains as well. So, the Almighty Allah talked about different kinds of waters and different benefits of them. And in this verse, another aspect of water is brought up. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا. He has created a man from water also. We concluded that since the other verses suggest the purpose of water here is the sperm from which all people are generated by Allah's might. فَجَعَلَهُ نَسَبًا وَصِهْرًا. And he made him related in blood and wedlock. We also said that these two are talking about the indirect cause in the subject of marriage. In chapter Nisa, seven of the unmarriageable ones, the mother, daughter, sister of mother, sister of father, daughter of brother, daughter of sister, that are created by lineage or parentage are mentioned, and also four cases of the indirect cause, daughter of wife, mother of wife, wife of issue, and wife of father are mentioned. Of course, there are other opinions about this sentence stated by commentators, but this one is stronger and clearer, including this one. Some say that the word nasab means male offspring, and the word sihr means female offspring, because blood relationships traditionally are counted depending on fathers and not mothers. But as we said earlier in this program and in the previous episode, the other verses of the Holy Quran suggest that this verse is talking about the different subjects of marriage. And also, other verses of the Holy Quran, specifically the 61st verse of chapter Ali Imran, suggests that if we believe that brother relationships are counted only depending on fathers, it is a big mistake, and it is originated from the customs and the traditions that were before Islam. These traditions thought that blood relationship has been originated only from father and mother has no role. But as it is specified by Islam jurisprudence and all the Islam learned persons, all ordinances that are about lineally being unmarriageable are from both the father side and the mother.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
It is interesting that there is a famous tradition which is recorded in Shi'i and Sunni books. According to this tradition, this verse is sent down about the Prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, and Imam Ali alayhi salam. Because the Prophet ﷺ married his daughter Fatima off to Ali alayhi salam, and therefore Ali was both the cousin of the Prophet and the spouse of his daughter. This is the meaning of the Quranic phrase nasaban wa sihra, related in blood and in wedlock. But as we have repeatedly mentioned, these narrations are some clear extensions of the verse. These different meanings mentioned by the commentators do not prevent the generality of the meaning of the verse. This verse includes any relationship that is created by the way of blood and marriage, and one of its clear extensions is the bilateral relationship of Ali alayhi salam and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. And at the end of the verse, in order to put emphasis on the former issues, the Quran says, وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا, and your Lord is ever powerful. Your Lord is the one who has created all different kinds of people from this very simple water. He created life from water. He enlivened the earth by this water. He let you live on the earth using this water and its enlivening effects, and he made you yourselves also from a kind of water. So that is why you have to believe in the power of your Lord. وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا, and your Lord is ever powerful. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. When faith begins.
اللهم أهل الكبرياء والعظمة وأهل الجود والجبروت وأهل العفو والرحمة وأهل التقوى والمغفرة أسألك بحق هذا اليوم الذي جعلته للمسلمين عيدا ولمحمد صلى الله عليه وآله زخرا وشرفا وكرامة.
و We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate the Islamic Ummah and all world Muslims on the blessed occasion of the Eid al-Fitr. A joyous Eid al-Fitr to you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Celebrated in France with hundreds of marches nationwide as leftists of all sorts united to celebrate equality, solidarity, and worker empowerment.
Le 1er mai.
The 1st of May is the international day for workers to get together and discuss how to defend themselves. It's seemingly the only day where workers mobilize for their rights worldwide, and we see how there are so many countries represented here. Today is more important than any election or particular movement.
In 2020 and 2021, May Day was muted due to the coronavirus pandemic. The celebration is back to full strength this year, and many marchers have an added reason to be politically active. The recent re-election of Emmanuel Macron following a campaign dominated by the far right. Economic stagnation, record inflation, a bitter election campaign with results few are genuinely happy about. Many believe some changes are coming for France. The French left is in the middle of perhaps a major reconstitution. The communists, greens, and socialists are deciding whether or not to join forces behind Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who finished third in the presidential race. Should they unite for the June legislative elections, they could deny Macron absolute control of parliament and thus drastically change his plans for his second term.
I can't recall the last time people felt they were actually voting for someone rather than voting to eliminate something. But not everyone here accepts this logic of reformism. We workers who produce the wealth need to prove an alternative to this system, like the yellow vests do, through consciousness and organization.
Unions, notably quiet during the presidential campaign, were out in big numbers, though far from records. Police, normally elbow to elbow with protesters at yellow vest demonstrations, gave marchers plenty of room, with few serious confrontations reported. May Day 2019 is often considered the end of the major yellow vest demonstrations. Hundreds of arrests, warrantless searches starting from a 150-kilometer radius around Paris, and massive police violence gutted the average person's willingness to join 6 months of enormous anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
People in the Gaza Strip mark this year's Eid al-Fitr holiday for the 16th time under the Israeli blockade. The joyful occasion comes at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Traditionally, Muslims go to markets several days before Eid to buy gifts, new clothes, and sweets for their loved ones, but many here can't afford that because of the high unemployment and poverty rates. United Nations figures show that 80% of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been relying on handouts in recent years in order to survive.
I'm having a very hard time while trying to buy new clothes for the holiday. I'm on a very tight budget, and I really don't know how to get through this holiday. There is hardly any money in Gaza, and the situation is only getting worse day after day.
For Gazan families, it has been a very tough task to buy Eid items for their children amid the harsh economic situation in the besieged coastal enclave. People scour the markets for hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
Most Gazans are broke and can't buy Eid items for their families. Gifts and clothes are very expensive, but we're determined to celebrate this holiday. The Israeli blockade and the last wars will not steal our joy.
For merchants, this Eid season has been one of the worst they had in years. Usually during holidays like Eid al-Fitr, sales are high in markets around the world. But in Gaza, shop owners complain of lack of sales.
This has been the most difficult economic condition in over a decade, and people lack the purchasing power. Most people come to the market just to look around, and they hardly buy anything because the economic situation here is very bad. Things are tough, but the spirit of Eid al-Fitr is here, and people will try to make the best of it.
Despite the harsh circumstances, Palestinians in Gaza are preparing themselves to receive Eid al-Fitr holiday like all Muslims around the world.
Eid celebrations in the besieged Gaza Strip will undoubtedly fall short of being full due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the US and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country. And most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate yellow vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the yellow vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the yellow vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted yellow vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their yellow vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the yellow vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years. Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt, all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume, and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes.
The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the Muska. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations also get to introduce their Ramadan traditions and what they have for iftar breakfast.
In Syria, it's customary to break a Ramadan fast with our traditional appetizers such as fattoush and tabbouleh. In my city, Aleppo, we start with dairy such as hot milk. Afterwards, we eat the main dish, which varies from a city to the other.
In Afghanistan, we cook our delicious gulani and ashak for Ramadan breakfast. These foods actually are cooked for our dearest guests in other months of the year.
Organized jointly by Iran's Eco Office and the Culture Ministry, the event seeks to bring about a stronger bond between Muslim nations by sharing their cultures and traditions.
Here, Muslims get together to find their commonalities and at the same time learn about their differences. The expo also brought exhibitors coming from ECO member states. The reason we held it in the holy month of Ramadan is to say that despite all our differences, all of us are Muslims and need to unite.
Muslims say Ramadan brings them together more than any other time, since they all practice the same religious tasks throughout the month. And as the call to prayers resonated in the exhibition, all fasting Muslims left the expo for a shared iftar breakfast.
Despite all the differences in languages, costumes, and even Ramadan meals, people here say they feel like they're one nation, since they all come from Muslim countries. And organizers say this is what Ramadan offers, a taste of peace and friendship that transcends all differences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghanistan, once again facing waves of deadly attacks. In the latest incident, a powerful explosion hit Khalifa Sahib Mosque in the capital Kabul, killing and injuring dozens of worshippers.
Every Friday, people come to the mosque to say their prayers. Hearing the bomb explosion, I entered the mosque. I am shocked as I'm talking. We took more than 200 casualties to the hospital. It was so horrifying that I had never witnessed such a scene.
Previously, we were falling victim to the US and Taliban war. However, the situation has now changed, but we are still being killed in the mosques and schools. We don't know who are carrying out such blind attacks, but I'm sure the attackers are not Muslims.
Exhausted by growing violence, people of Afghanistan are calling for an end to terror attacks and punishment for the perpetrators.
In my opinion, the recent attacks on specific groups and places show that the enemies of the people of Afghanistan are trying to sow sedition among Muslims and impose another proxy war on Afghans. The Taliban, as new rulers, are obliged to protect Afghans and bring the terrorists to justice.
The international community should take action in ending violence in Afghanistan. They know the roots of terrorist groups or criminal bonds. They should help Afghans with practicing stability. If they are voicing human rights, so why they are watching us falling victim to terrorism?
In the recent days, several large bomb attacks targeted public places in the capital Kabul, Mazar-i Sharif, and Kunduz provinces. The attacks have taken a scores of lives, mostly from the Hazara community. Bomb attacks in Afghanistan continue as Afghans are observing the holy month of Ramadan. People here believe their enemies are missing no chance to harm innocent Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This iftar table stretches for 5 kilometers. Organized by Tehran's Grand Bazaar, the event served iftar to over 5,000 people, mostly low-income families. Organizers say it is the longest iftar spread ever hosted in the world.
I'm honored to have the chance to host my fellow citizens for an iftar dinner. The Grand Bazaar of Tehran started this initiative with the aim of helping the less privileged. Throughout the year, we launch many charity initiatives, but its climax is in Ramadan, because it is the month of kindness.
This is the second time Tehran's Grand Bazaar hosts such a large-scale iftar meal as a charity gesture. The benefactors who contributed to the event say Ramadan is a time to push the limits on humanity and put a smile on the faces of the needy.
It's so beautiful when you see the rich and the poor sit around the same iftar spread and break their Ramadan fast. I'm so happy to be a part of this, and I hope such humanitarian gestures will be promoted to hopefully root out poverty.
Every year in Ramadan, charity works get supercharged, with Muslims trying to pitch in to have a say in helping the poor, as they believe Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking, but it's a time for sharing love and kindness with fellow human beings.
With all its beautiful celebrations like this large iftar party, Ramadan is about to come to an end. But organizers say what's important is to learn the lessons of Ramadan on the beauty of kindness and togetherness, which if practiced, the world would be a better place to live. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip rallied on Friday to mark International Quds Day. Millions of people around the world hold rallies every year to mark this day, which takes place on the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, to support the people of Palestine. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. The big event was organized by the Islamic Jihad movement.
Today we mark International Quds Day, while freedom fighters from Gaza, Yemen, Tehran, Lebanon and Syria, as well as in other places around the world, stand united for the sake of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day was declared in 1979 by the founder of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the late Ayatollah Khomeini, to drum up international solidarity for the Palestinian people. People at the rally expressed their gratitude to Imam Khomeini for his historic initiative.
On International Quds Day, we say to the whole world that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of Al-Quds. We also want to express our deepest gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran and Imam Khomeini for this important occasion in solidarity with Al-Quds.
Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to its religious status. Extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in recent days.
Imam Khomeini's designation of this day is of great importance because it unites all resistance fronts for the sake of supporting Palestine and Al-Quds. These fronts are united today more than ever to help secure the liberation of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day is observed in over 80 countries around the globe.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians and has turned a blind eye to the Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah held a rally to commemorate International Quds Day. Secretary General of the resistance movement Said Hassan Nasrallah addressed the gathering, stressing that the latest individual operations by Palestinians have once again shown the weakness of the Israeli regime, while proving that the Palestinian people have not forgotten their cause, but have rather become more hopeful in the liberation of their land.
The Palestinians told the Israelis over the past weeks that they cannot occupy Palestine and still enjoy security. The military confrontations have proven to be capable of achieving victories and defeating the enemy, and this path must continue. Liberating Palestine might not need great armies or weapons, but rather martyrdom fighters.
Said Nasrallah also warned the Israelis that any uncalculated move during their military drills in May will lead to a direct retaliation from Hezbollah.
When the Israeli exercises begin, the resistance in Lebanon will be at the highest levels of alert and readiness. We tell the Israeli enemy not to bet on exhaustion or hunger or poverty. Any act of foolishness will be met with an immediate response.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon once more reiterated the regional strategy that any assault on Al-Quds will lead to a regional war. Palestinians in Lebanon also attended the rally in Beirut and held several gatherings in refugee camps. They also were vocal in asserting that they are with the pro-armed struggle.
We tell our people, the youth of Al-Quds, where 250,000 have gathered to fortify and defend this holy site. They are defending the dignity of the entire nation. Today we are commemorating this day not only in solidarity, but we are commemorating with the sword of Al-Quds. We are the children of the sword. We are the sons of the resistance and the front of the resistance. And with resistance, we shall liberate Al-Quds and defend human dignity.
Despite being away from their homeland, Palestinian refugees said their hearts and minds are with their people.
International Quds Day is seen by many across the globe as a day to denounce Israeli oppression and occupation of Palestinian land. For Palestinians in the diaspora, it is a day to renew their decades-long struggle to return to their homeland. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La 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 la
we are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.